Chapter 26. After a quick hug, Auntie motions for me to sit down. I need to get Granny's coffee and lunch, I say.
No, my girl, Granny June says, you need to sit down.
Granny's part of the intervention? Shit times infinity. Chimo. What if this is about the investigation? How much do they know? What is the least amount of truth I can say before it feels like a lie? Auntie places a large yellow envelope in front of me. Huh? What's this, Auntie?
Just open it, she says. I didn't want to do this here, but you've been avoiding me.
Guilt makes my cheeks feel hot. I open the envelope and two pictures fall out. My heart skips when I glimpse two children skating with a large man. A color photograph of Dad with Levi and me. I search for his jade green scarf, but it's not there. The other is a black and white photo of my father holding me on his lap. I'm a baby, my dark hair sticking up, big eyes, pale skin contrasting with his. He's looking at me and smiling. Speechless, I meet Auntie's eyes.
Turn it over, she says.
It's my father's distinctive handwriting. He wrote one word on the back. Nadonis. Putting the N in front of the word adds the possessive. My daughter. Josette found them when she was cleaning her mom's attic. Great Aunt Nancy had some round tins full of old photographs. Go on, Auntie nudges me. I slide a stack of documents from the envelope. The one on top makes me gasp. Application for tribal enrollment, special circumstances. Auntie nods, urging me to look at the papers. A notarized letter from my mother explains that she was a minor when she gave birth, and her parents refused to include my father's name on the birth certificate. Affidavits from Theodora Sarah Firekeeper Birch, Josette Elaine Firekeeper, and Norman Marshall Firekeeper, who has written his nickname, Monk, in parentheses, because no one has used his given name since the priest baptized him. There is a firekeeper family tree with the three relatives' names highlighted. Auntie labeled each with the official relationship. I never knew Cousin Josette is my second cousin once removed, or that Monk is actually my great uncle, even though he is a year younger than Auntie. All three have attested that Donis Lorenza Fontaine is the biological daughter of Levi Joseph Firekeeper Sr. You have until your 19th birthday to file the application, along with a paternity test that you and I take to verify lineage, Auntie says. My birthday is October 1st, 7 days away. This. I have wanted this ever since I understood that being Anishinaabe and being an enrolled citizen weren't necessarily the same thing. My mind races, remembering Granny's unsuccessful efforts to get this for Lily. I can become a member. Except, it changes nothing about me. I am Anishinaabe. Since my first breath, even before when my new spirit traveled here, I will be Anishinaabe even when my heart stops beating and I journey to the next world. My whole life, I've been seeking validation of my identity from others. Now that it's within reach, I realize I don't need it. Miigwech. I take a deep breath. But I don't need a card to define me. I know you don't, Donis. But think about it, Auntie says. This is a gift from your dad. I sit with that. I have his facial features, his height, his skill on the ice. Mom says I have his laugh. My father has given me many gifts. All I ever wanted was more time with him. Once, during the 3 months that I was TJ's girlfriend, I was at his house for the Packers-Lions game. TJ's little sister, Tila, snuggled next to their dad on the sofa, laying her head on his chest. Everyone was cheering loudly, but she fell asleep listening to her daddy's steady heartbeat. I had hungered for that moment for myself. Granny says, "Your decision isn't just about you.
It's for your children, grandchildren. People say to think 7 generations ahead when making big decisions, because our future ancestors, those yet to arrive, who will one day become the elders, live with the choices we make today. The investigation. I think back to Ron's suggestion that enrollment could help my efforts. Could he be right? I feel ashamed for allowing the thought to flicker, even for a second. Another thought vies for a brain space. As he reminded me this morning, Jamie is here temporarily. The FBI is concerned only with what's happening right now. They cannot fathom that their actions might have far-reaching effects. Maybe it's even more important for me to be part of the investigation because I'm the only one thinking 7 generations ahead. Okay, I nod. I want to enroll. Auntie breaks into a smile. I've missed seeing it. There's one more requirement, my aunt says. You need 3 affidavits from tribal elders who are not related or who are more distantly related than 3rd degree. My mind scrambles through people who might come through for me. Granny June, for sure. Minnie, too. Maybe I can ask John C. Keewaydin. Sini Nimki approaches the table. She places a paper in front of me. It's an affidavit attesting my parentage with her signature, certified by Judge Dana Firekeeper. I try to speak, but the words get stuck in my throat. I stand and hug her. She pats my back gruffly. When Sini releases me, Granny hands me a 2nd affidavit. I blink repeatedly, not to conjure my dad, but because through my tears I can barely see the line of people forming behind Granny June and Minnie. My application for tribal enrollment will include 26 elder affidavits. I alternate between grinning and sobbing all the way to Chimakwa Arena. The cargo hold doors are already closed, so I leap onto the booster bus with my overnight bag in hand. The booster's treasurer takes my check for transportation, community refreshments, and 2 nights lodging. I pause, wondering if the rumors are true, and she's about to hand me a non-disclosure agreement to sign. You're all set? Go find a seat. She cracks open a beer and offers it to me. Her nephew graduated with me. She knows I'm not 21. I accept it. Someone shouts my name from the back of the bus. Call me Grant, motions toward an empty seat near him. I scan for any other option and am delighted to see that Ron saved a seat for me. The team left yesterday. The players, still in high school, have special schedules where attendance rules take a backseat to hockey schedules. Ron's request for a half-day substitute teacher was approved without any fuss because special allowances always get made when it comes to hockey. Most of the boosters are Zaganash. I see only 2 tribal members. I tell Ron there's a caravan of RVs following the bus, and a good number of those are filled with Nishnabs who prefer their own campers and trailers. Why is that? Ron asks, surveying the 50 or so people drinking and chatting amiably. When the bus speakers blast out the opening piano chords of Journey's Don't Stop Believin', 4 rows of women lose their shit, squealing and jumping up and down. That's why. I point with my lips toward them. More than a few are already Gishguebi, and we haven't even left the city limits. I've heard enough stories to know. Ron snickers and gives a discreet eye roll. I whisper, some of them are the same ones who say Indians can't hold their liquor or that per cap doesn't buy class. One of the ladies is so overcome by the magic of Steve Perry's vocals that she flashes a truck driver next to the bus as we head south on I-75. Everyone cheers when the trucker blasts his horn in appreciation. I laugh at Ron's astonished expression. I'm still giddy, riding a wave of happiness as I replay the memory of each elder handing me an affidavit and hugging me. It is a feeling so profound, there must be a word in Anishinaabemowin for it. Nouns in the language are either animate, living, or inanimate. I'll ask Auntie if feelings are animate, too, because this one has good energy to it. As the ride continues, I grab a book from my bag. A According to the American Literature syllabus, there will be an essay due next week on The Sound and the Fury. I spend the next 2 hours attempting to read. From the corner of my eye, I catch Ron observing me. "What?" I say, closing the book. "You haven't turned a page in 20 minutes," he remarks. "Well, this is crazy hard to get through. It's someone's stream of consciousness. His thoughts go everywhere and time jumps around. It's so hard to follow." Lily was supposed to help me dive beneath the surface to find the deeper meanings. "Benji," Ron names the narrator of the book's first section. My jaw drops. "You know Faulkner?" "Time is a theme, Donis. Benji's thoughts aren't bound by time, but his brother Quentin is tethered to it." "Whoa. There it is, the deeper meaning beyond my grasp. Does everyone understand except me?" "Stories should go from A to B to C," I say. "Maybe it's the scientist in you, wanting everything to follow a precise sequence." "Uh-huh. You're a scientist too, Ron. Plus, why is order a bad thing? Like taxonomy, categorizing living and extinct organisms by an 8-level classification system. Domain, kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, species. Same with the periodic table of elements. Rules are a good thing. How can you trust the unknown?" Ron smiles. "Non-linear thinking can be disjointed, like Benji's thoughts. But if you step back or follow it to the end, sometimes it comes full circle." "Hmm," I say, unconvinced. "Maybe the point is patience. Trust that the answers will be revealed when you're ready." Surprised, I turn away and pretend to bury myself back in my book, blinking back tears as the bus crosses into Wisconsin. We just had a conversation that had nothing to do with the investigation. Ron reminds me of Uncle David, who always took time to explain things I didn't understand. I don't recall thinking about my uncle today. Does that mean my grief is shrinking? Will there come a day when Lily isn't part of my everyday thinking? Grief is a cruel and sneaky bastard. You love a person, and then they're gone. Past tense. You forget them for an hour, a day, a week. How is that even possible? It happens because memories are fickle. They can fade. I wanted to help the investigation for Lily. Now my motives seem less clear. I'm terrified at the thought of the world and me going on without Lily. The rest of the bus ride is like a fog. It doesn't lift until I'm sitting in the bleachers at the game, when Call Me Grant plants himself next to me. Mrs. Edwards doesn't travel to away games leading up to Shagala, which is quickly approaching. It's her busiest and favorite time of year. I know he won't try anything with Ron sitting next to me, but I still do my best to ignore him. Instead, I focus on the conversations around me. When I overhear someone behind me mention PerCap, my ears perk up. It happens all the time. I overhear some Zuganash talking about the tribe in general or some particular niche. And what they say about my tribal community when they think no one is listening, it is never good. Now's my window to walk away before actually hearing anything. I prepare to leave, but realize I'd need to climb over Ron and a bunch of people to my left or Call Me Grant on my right to escape. Shit. "Tina Shino's boy," says one of the guys. I recognize him as the attorney who once offered his services to ensure that I received my fair share of Grandpa Lorenzo's estate. I told him to go to hell. He must mean Ryan Shino, a guy I graduated with. Ryan is a smarmy jerk, always saying shit about niche knobs, wanting you to explain why tribal members can hunt at different times than allowed by state law, or pay a reduced price for gas that doesn't include the state taxes. I've watched niche kids try to explain about treaty rights, which he would loudly declare outdated legal concepts as antiquated as fiefdoms and feudalism. The more frustrated and angry they become, the more smug Ryan seems. as if his goal isn't to become enlightened, but rather to make you waste your time and energy. No kidding, someone chimes in. When's his hearing? October 4th. Their enrollment committee forwarded it to Tribal Council for Action. He had to file his case before he turned 19. Ryan Chenault is applying for membership in the tribe? Now I'm hanging on to every word, even as they twist my insides. I didn't know Ryan's dad was Joey Noden, says one of the guys. Yeah, Tina Chenault didn't want anyone knowing either. Joey'd have fought for custody of that per cap check, too. Can you blame her? They all laugh. Kid just hit the lottery. More laughter. You get any of his winnings? Someone asks. The lawyer answers. Percentage of his per cap for 10 years. They cheer. Someone claps him on the back. I don't realize my hands are clenched until Ron pats my arm. He gives me a look of understanding. He heard, too. Unclenching my fists, I try focusing on the game, but my mind goes to Lily. Each tribe has the sovereign right to determine who is a member. My best friend couldn't get enrolled because of the way the Sugar Island Ojibwe tribe's enrollment office calculated Indian blood quantum, fractions of Indian blood based on lineage. Granny June's first husband was from a First Nations band in Canada, so Lily's pedigree didn't meet the standard. Too many ancestors from across the river, not the right kind of Indian blood. Granny filed an appeal with tribal council, telling them, "No one told me I wasn't supposed to snag on that side of the river. We were here before that border existed. Every one of you's got cousins over there." But council rejected her appeal for Lily's membership application. If I submit my documentation before October 1st, Tribal Council will vote on my and Ryan's applications at their next official meeting. His identity is not my concern, I remind myself. Instead, I remember the joy that grew inside me with each hug from my elders. I wish Lily had known a moment like that. When Ron and I walk back to the bus for the ride to the hotel, he deliberately slows his steps to separate us from the boosters. "I hope you can understand, Donis, why I told Jamie it might be better to cool it with the boyfriend-girlfriend act," Ron says quietly. "Huh? Is that why Jamie acted strange on Monday and has been so standoffish this week?" I consider my response to Ron. I'm thinking like a secret squirrel. I want information without giving anything in return. "You're gonna need to explain it to me," I say in my best Ryan Chenault imitation. "Undercover operatives, especially young field agents, sometimes get too enthusiastic about their assignments. They develop emotional connections with suspects or informants. It happens often enough that senior field agents, like me, know what to look for." Ron waits for me to say something. When I don't, he stops walking. "What I saw Sunday night? At least one of you was not acting,"